On behalf of the USDA Agriculture Research Service, I'd like to welcome all of you to the 2019 Benjamin Y. Morrison Memorial Lecture. Thank you for being here with us this evening, because I know that there are many competing events. I also want to thank all of you for what you do. You bring us the specialty and nursery crops that enhance our lives, the flowers and trees in our gardens, the landscaping plants in our parks, the fruits and vegetables in every grocery and farmer's market in this country. I can't thank you enough for the work you do and for your efforts to make our world a better place. And that's why I'm so proud that ARS partners with ASHS to co-sponsor the Benjamin Y. Morrison Lecture. This memorial lecture series recognizes scientists who've made unique contributions to horticulture and other environmental sciences, to encourage the use of these sciences, and to stress the necessity to preserve and enhance the natural beauty all around us. That's why it's so important that we get great nominees for the lecture, like today's speaker. It won't be long before we begin next year's process, so please be thinking of our next excellent lecturer and sending your nominations by next January. There are links on the ARS website you can use to submit your nominations and or answer, send in any questions that you might have. Now, there may be a few of you here today who don't know about Dr. Morrison. I find that hard to believe, but he was the first director of the USDA's National Arboretum in Washington, D.C. And as a scientist, plant breeder, landscape architect, plant explorer, author, and lecturer, he advanced the science of botany and horticulture in the United States. In 1968, ARS and ASHS established this annual lecture to honor his legacy and his efforts. And this afternoon, I'm delighted to introduce a person who reflects Dr. Morrison's legacy. Dr. Mary Meyer is currently a professor and extension horticulturist at the University of Minnesota. As with Dr. Morrison, for most of you today, Dr. Meyer needs no introduction. Through the years, she has been a vital partner in much of the extensive work and outreach of the ASHS. When she served as the ASHS president, she helped start the Seed Your Future initiative, a partnership with industry and academic partners to promote the field of horticulture as a promising career path. Like Dr. Morrison, she has known the challenges and rewards of serving as a director of an arboretum. In her case, the Minnesota Landscape Arboretum, where she has curated an extensive collection of ornamental grasses and sedges. Like Dr. Morrison, she has been a persuasive advocate for horticulture and has spent as much of her time educating the public about the essential role of horticulture in our lives as she has in the lab and in the field. And like Dr. Morrison, who is perhaps best known for his breeding work with azaleas, her noteworthy research has made her a horticultural pioneer in her own right. In her studies, she has identified the horticultural opportunities offered by ornamental grasses and sedges, many of them native to North America, and has championed their breeding and use for making our landscapes more diverse, healthier, and attractive. We are proud to have this opportunity today to mark the many accomplishments of Dr. Meyer throughout her career as a scientist, educator, and as an advocate. So without further delay, it is with great pleasure I introduce you to the 2019 Benjamin Y. Morrison Lecturer, Dr. Mary Meyer. Dr. Meyer, if you please join me at the podium. ARS has created a special medal for this occasion that I now present to you, along with a check, but we use high tech. Here we have direct deposit now. So with this medal, we'd like to honor you and your accomplishments and your efforts. And if you would take a look that direction. One final note. Following Dr. Meyer's presentation, we will hold a reception here in this room. So we ask that you please join us so that you might congratulate her personally. And without further ado, Dr. Meyer, you have the floor.
Thank you. Thank you, Chavandra, for that nice introduction. It's a great honor and a privilege to be with you today to give the Morrison lecture. But I am in a room with many brilliant people, and there are many of you, all of you, who could be up here just as well as me, especially after being here for 3 days and hearing all of your lectures and wonderful research projects that you're working on. So I just happen to be the one that's going to talk for a little bit longer today than maybe some of the rest of you, but many of you certainly deserve to be up here. So I'm not going to talk about my grass research, even though Chavandra talked a lot about that, and a lot of times that's what this lecture is about research, which is wonderful. I'm going to talk about what's on your bucket list for horticulture. So I think we've all got a bucket list, and you probably all know what a bucket list is or have. Usually this is associated with travel, right? Some experience or some place that you really want to go or something that you want to do. So Casey Sclair, who's the executive director for APGA, used this term horticulture bucket list a while ago, and I thought, Casey, horticulture bucket list, what the heck? Well, what was on Casey's horticulture bucket list but this wonderful, let's see if this pointer works, this wonderful citrus collection out there in Riverside, California. This has been on my list for a long time. I have not seen this citrus collection. So how many of you have seen this citrus collection out there? Yeah, so a few, okay. So then what happens is Monday, the first day of the conference, Walter Swiggle gets the Hall of Fame Award here at ASHS, finally, after many, many years. And he made the Limequat. Well, I'm embarrassed to say, okay, maybe because I'm a Minnesotan, I can say this. I did not know there was a Limequat. I did not know there was a Limequat, and I have obviously never tasted a Limequat. Now, how many of you have tasted a Limequat? Okay, there are a few of you who have tasted Limequat, so this is now on my list to taste a Limequat. I've never seen one in the store, but now we all know the Limequat is out there. But getting back to the bucket list, mostly this is travel. But I got to thinking about horticulture and our field, and what if there was a list of what would be on your bucket list, what's on my bucket list for our industry, our field of horticulture. So I have come up with my list, and I'm going to talk to you briefly about these five things that are on my horticultural bucket list. But I hope by the end of today you have got a horticultural bucket list, and you might only have one thing that's on your list, and that's great, but that's what this is about today, thinking about our whole industry and what should be on our lists. So this is the key about my talk, here, this one sentence. Is it our failure to imagine the changes we want to see in horticulture? So I think the answer to that is no, because we have a room full of brilliant people, brilliant scientists. We couldn't have any failure to imagine the best things in the world with horticulture. We're working on these, aren't we? We hope so. So just keep that in mind. Is it our failure to imagine the changes we want to see in horticulture? So the first thing on my bucket list is better plant variety and cultivar recognition with the public. So we have this apple called the Honeycrisp apple. So, you know, Minnesota, Jim Luby, Dave Bedford up in Minnesota developed this apple. So you all have tasted this, right? Everybody knows the Honeycrisp apple. So I do career tours for young students, high schoolers in Minnesota. Now, most kids know the Honeycrisp apple. This is great. This is tremendous recognition. They know that crisp apple. They know that variety. Well, they don't know carrot varieties. They don't know plum varieties. They don't know sweet potato varieties. And we've got a lot of great horticultural crops. So why is it the public doesn't know a variety name for every one of our fruits and vegetables? Why is that? Is that our failure to imagine what should be going on with horticulture? So how many of you have eaten the cotton candy? Cotton candy grape? Oh, whoa, you folks are with it. You folks are with it. So I didn't know about the cotton candy grape till I read about it in Costco's magazine. So then I go to Costco and say, where's the cotton candy grape? We don't have the cotton candy grape. Oh, forget that, lady. You won't find the cotton candy grape. And I was like, look, it's in your magazine. So I'm in Target one day, and there's the cotton candy grape in Target, $2.49 a pound. The cotton candy grape is a premium grape, 12% more sugar. I take it home. My husband says, I don't know if there's any difference in this. So then I did taste tests and so on. You get a ripe cotton candy grape. Yes, there is a big difference in that grape. I think most people agree with that. So how about moondrop? Has anybody eaten moondrop? Anybody seen it? Look at that grape. Can you see what that is? So this is a company, those of you that are in the grape world, you know this, the grapery and what's going on with grapes. So look at that moondrop grape down there, the cotton candy grape. So this is a company and business out of California that's marketing on brand, this is maybe brand, but it's really varieties. They're marketing those varieties to people. So David Kane, are you here? Probably not, right? Probably not coming here anyway. This is what David says. You can go to the supermarket, it's like 15 kinds of apples, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, we want to give consumers the same array of flavors for grapes. And why not? Why not do that? Why not have people asking for cotton candy? So this over here on the right, I know this is small and hard to see that. These are what they call novelty varieties and core varieties coming out of this work and this breeding program. So some of our, where are the folks from Arkansas? Did I talk about that? I forgot that. Isn't Arkansas? Yes. University of Arkansas, there's some genetics from you folks from Arkansas in this cotton candy grape. Right here, John Clark, you know this. See, John, you should be giving this talk, right? Not me. You should be up here giving this talk. I mean, but really, this is the point. All of our crops, where is that Dan Leinberger? Where is that maroon and orange carrot? What's the name of that carrot?
It's Betta Sweet.
Right, Betta Sweet. I mean, this is a carrot. Why don't we get that carrot in there by variety name in the grocery store? So I know this is complicated. I know I'm talking about perishable crops. They're different than apples, etc. This is a brand in the Lunds and Byerly's. That's a local grocery store in Minnesota. But the Lori Ann Peach, has anybody seen this? Is a brand of several, like four or five different peach cultivars sold in the store. This is a beautiful peach. I think they are very controlled about how this is grown and how it's not refrigerated and sold in the store when it's ripe. But every Lori Ann peach I've had has tasted very good. Okay, so Driscoll's. Any Driscoll's folks in the audience? So I had a great experience with strawberries. You know, we're all eating Driscoll's berries. They're wonderful. They're the predominant brand that I see in the store. And this is about in May, peak season for probably California. I tasted some of the best strawberries I've ever had from the grocery store. And this is what was on the bottom of that container. This strawberry had the flavors, Harry Klee talked today, the flavors, the aromas, the scent that reminded me of Pennsylvania growing up picking wild strawberries. This strawberry was excellent. So I thought, great, I'm going to find out what this strawberry is. So I sent this picture to Driscoll's, and I said, what is this? What berry is this? And this is what Driscoll said. We are not able to identify which variety of strawberries. We can give you a coupon for 50 cents to go to the grocery store. And they did, and that was nice. But they're missing the point here. So is this our failure to understand, to really think about what we can do in horticulture, to imagine how to advance and sell more strawberries. So when I was a kid growing up in Pennsylvania, there were 2 weeks in the year you could pick blueberries. We used to go to Blueberry Acres, and my mother would can or freeze blueberries, and that was it. After those 2 weeks, forget it. You couldn't go buy fresh blueberries. You couldn't find them. But today, we have fresh blueberries year-round because of our great horticulture industry and the advances that we have made with varieties, growing them around the world, just lots of things. And, of course, people know blueberries are good for you now. And so this is just a chart from our colleagues about the changes with consumption with blueberries. But there's no marketing of blueberry cultivars. Maybe there's not much of a difference with blueberry cultivars. I don't know. But blueberry is an example here of something that has really changed. I could have talked to you just about new crops and different crops because there's huge potential there. But we really know now, a couple of my ideas here really talk about this plant-based diet. We know this. This is a big, big deal in our lives. Eating plants is how we're going to live longer. It's how we function much better. But we're not doing a lot to really promote this from a horticulture end of it. And the carrot out of Texas A&M, I mean, that was superior with the health benefits, right? And today, I just came out of a talk where someone was talking about purple lettuce has the same health quality as blueberries. Purple lettuce? Really? Who knew that? I mean, yeah, so we have great potential there. We could be up in Minnesota. Look, this is a talk. Is this the 24th or the 25th? This is cancer prevention. So you see those pills on the right, and you see those vegetables on the left. It's kind of the same thing. So another example, so this just doesn't have to apply to vegetables or fruits, but this is our Bailey Nursery, our wonderful nursery in Minnesota, supplied 3,500 endless summer bloomstrucks for the Super Bowl when it was in Minnesota. There was all that certain variety of hydrangea, and now Bailey's is using endless summer hydrangea on this program, Interior Designer's Queer Eye. So if you watch that show or see that, I don't, but you can see endless summer hydrangea. So this is just another example. It doesn't have to be just fruits and vegetables. It can be our ornamentals as well. So the second idea is gardens in all aspects of our lives. Can we have a garden in every home, every hospital, school, workplace, and nursing home? So many of you probably know Oliver Sacks. He was a neurologist, a medical doctor, as well as an author. He wrote an essay that was first published in 2009 in this book that's listed here. And this essay was recently reprinted, just in April. It came out again in the New York Times. So it was through social media, it just went a lot of places. And people sent it to me, the public gardens, people were talking about it and so on, because of what Oliver Sacks was saying then and saying again now about the healing power of gardens. So we know biophilia with E.O. White's theory that humans love to be with other forms of life, animals, plants, whatever. But Oliver Sacks has this hortophilia. I mean, who's heard of hortophilia before? Yes. Yeah, Dan. Yeah, so two or three people. So he's defined this. He defined this in 2009, the desire to interact with, manage, or tend nature. So this is what we do in horticulture because plants are responsive. They respond to us. This is a tremendous quote that he had about his patients. This is his medical field. I've often seen the restorative and healing powers of nature in gardens, even for those who are deeply disabled neurologically. In many cases, gardens and nature are more powerful than any medication. So we know this, right? We are all horticulturists. That's why we're in this field. We know this. But a lot of people still discount this. Methodist Hospital, this is near where I live, where my daughter had one of my daughters had her babies there. Methodist Hospital is a beautiful garden. Now, this is, yes, they transformed this. I know this looks like a wetland. It is a wetland, but it looked worse than this before. But these are the gardens around Methodist Hospital. So they have taken this very seriously to redo their grounds because of the healing and restorative power that plants have when people are ill. In the Wall Street Journal last fall was this article, "Should There Be a Garden at Every Hospital?" Not only for the healing power of nature, but because shouldn't the doctor be sending you home with a prescription? That's a bag of spinach and spaghetti squash. So again, the healing power of gardens. This is the Chelsea Flower Show, the Duchess of Cambridge. This is her, it is called the Royal Horticulture Society. So the queen goes, and now the lower queens go as well. But this is the garden that they have sponsored and worked on. But this garden is, many of these gardens now at the Chelsea Flower Show go somewhere else and live on and have another life. And whereas this was going, it's going to a hospital. So that's a little hard to read there. But again, showing the healing power that gardens have. Lots of you work on this, work with children and so on. We know the power of gardens being at every school. Children who grow up, who grow vegetables, grow up eating more vegetables, and of course they end up gardening. So if horticulture doesn't enter our daily lives, we are not as likely to be healthy, we're more likely to become ill, we're less likely to contribute to society. If you're not close to horticulture, your life is more stressful, less fulfilling, and less worthwhile. So wouldn't you like to work at Amazon? Yes, 40,000 plants. 400 people work in this headquarters, and they have 40,000 plants. What is that, 50 plants per person in this headquarters. Has anybody seen this? These geodesic domes, right? This is an incredible idea, but I mean, wow, what a place to work, huh? Hey, who's working at Longwood? We have some Longwood folks here. Nothing is better than working at Longwood or looking at a beautiful setting like this to work in. How would you like this to be the view from your office? Right? Nice. So I tried to make this no view from your office, right? Kind of nice, huh? Not so nice, right? Look at this view. I mean, isn't this a cool view? So many people live in urban areas, they don't have a chance for this view. But just looking at views like this, what does this do to us? How about this one? This is in the Art Institute right now in Minneapolis. This is Native American women art and artistry, but birds are in there, butterflies are in there, caterpillars. This is beadwork, but we see the plants, of course, but lots of other things in there as well. So this Terrapin Green Company has real, they do these biophilic designs, so with nature. So just look at this for a second. If you have a visual connection with nature, what I just showed with that beautiful scenery, did it lower your blood pressure and your heart rate? Do you feel better? Maybe you're already asleep because you've been at this meeting too long, right? No, but improve mental engagement and attentiveness once we see those things. Airflow, presence of water, just the sound of water reduces stress, increases tranquility, lowers our blood pressure. So we know all of these things, but are we imagining them and working with them to advance horticulture as much as possible? Okay, number three here is planting trees for climate change or our surroundings or our legacy. So this came out recently in the news. I'm sure you all heard this. I thought, this is great. This is easy, right? This is a guy from Swiss University, Tom Crowther, said possibly the most effective thing we can do to fight climate change is very simple. Plant trees, a trillion trees. Right? Can we imagine a trillion trees? So he has figured this out. We have 3 trillion trees today, and we have room for 1.2 trillion more. Right? It's a picture of some of my family with a tree that we planted. So if you look this up and find his website, he has the world and shows you the global tree density calculated by his team, and wherever it's yellow is potential for more forests. So you can see where that is in the United States. You can blow that up and you can look at it. So you might think, oh yeah, this is some great big lofty goal. Well, look at this guy, Felix Finkbenner. He founded Plant for the Planet in 2007, and he was 9. He's now a PhD student in this guy's lab in Switzerland. He's pictured in an award ceremony in 2015. His group, you can go online and look at this Plant for the Planet, has planted nearly 15 billion trees. And huge number, more, 2 billion are in India alone. So I thought, gee whiz, should I get up here and make a challenge for ASHS? How many trees could we plant? You know, let's go for a challenge and see what we can do with our organization. We have this wonderful anniversary. We've all been looking at the moon again and reliving that. And did you realize that this year they planted trees from Apollo 14 and in commemoration of the 50th anniversary for Apollo 11. So a moon tree garden has been planted. I've seen many of you with this on a T-shirt or in your signatures. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is now. So trees can be your legacy. You know, there's a book out now, How You Can Live Forever. Yes, How You Can Live Forever. I have not read this book. Have you read this book? No. How You Can Live Forever. Well, this is what I think they're going to tell you. Plant trees. Plant trees that you get your grandkids to name. So this is Maddie's tree on the right. That's Rex or Roland way back there in the middle. James is the blonde towhead. James's father, my son-in-law, is there. So we planted 10 trees at the Minnesota Landscape Arboretum. I have 10 immediate family members. They have each got their name on a tree now. And it's my grandkids going to watch those trees. Hopefully they'll each be planting 10 trees or more in their lifetime. Trees can be your legacy. You already knew that, didn't you? Okay, my next thing is horticultural plastics, recycled and reused. This is kind of a pet peeve of mine. Horticulture plastics should be recycled and reused. Consumers really want to do this. They're really upset with us. They ask me, what can I do with these things? Don't you want them at the Arboretum? People bring them back to us at the Arboretum. Lowe's and Home Depot have figured this out. Maybe they're just dumping everything back on the growers, right? I don't know. I don't know what they're doing. I've tried to figure it out from them. But it is a way to get you back into their store. So this is a big problem. This is a complex problem, and we have 100 different kinds of plastics that we're using in our industry. It's expensive, it's messy, but I feel it's only going to get worse. If you go to Lowe's or Home Depot, they're promoting the fact that they'll take back anything. It doesn't matter if you bought it there. It doesn't matter if it's a label, if it's a pot, or if it's a tray. They will take it back. Over at the United Kingdom, they're using different materials now. They're using a lot of paper, a lot of recyclable materials. There are new products on the market that are here in the United States. There's a lot of talk about not using tags anymore in pots. The public loves tags. The public loves tags, but the growers hate the tags. Maybe is a label on the pot the answer? Is a paper label on the pot a better answer? We can come up with the answers. The Royal Hort Society in England is sponsoring research for plastics, how to minimize or reduce the use of plastics. But is this our failure to imagine what we could do in horticulture? And my last bucket list, so I hope you've got something on your bucket list now, right? My last one, this plant blindness idea, which started Seed Your Future, is really not my idea. This is Jody Holt's idea from the University of California, Riverside. I don't think Jody comes to our meetings normally. She's a botanist. She was a science advisor for Avatar. She's the one who gave a lecture in Minnesota, and I heard that term, plant blindness. So that's the inability to see or notice one plants. Unfortunately, my husband has plant blindness. No matter what I do, I've been working on this, but it's tough. But we did start, of course, Seed Your Future. Susan Yoder, such a wonderful executive director. Many of you have supported this, universities, industries, and so on. This has made a big difference already with millions of students, middle school students, becoming more aware about horticulture. And the great thing is that young people love plants. Young people really understand and get it with plants. So there's a lot of resources that are up there. But I love this. This is what Anna Ball said just a couple of weeks ago at Cultivate. If you're a young person, you can come into this industry and make things happen. We are small enough that one person can make a huge difference, even change the future of the industry. We need to think beyond the greenhouse when we think about these jobs. This is really true. Those of you who have been in this industry a long time know there are a few people that you can be friends with. You can learn all you want to about blueberries and any small specific thing in horticulture. You can become a part of a small group and make a huge difference with this. This is another wonderful initiative with young people, the Collegiate Plant Initiative, the plant drop at many universities. This came out of a horticulture class at the University of Florida. So a great inspirational thing. There's a long list now of people that want to do this. I think Virginia told me like 25 schools want to do a plant drop. But young people love plants. They love our field. But I don't really know they understand or know what they could do with our field. But this is kind of a futuristic house with a look at where I think young people would like or how they'd like their plants to integrate with their lives. They want to be plant parents. But we need to continue to share our passion with them, our passion that we have for plants, and our legacy with horticulture being a wonderful and great field. So you know all the things I think that I've told you. I just want to leave you with this one question again. Is it our failure to imagine the changes that we want to see in horticulture? And I think no, it isn't, because all of you are brilliant working in this wonderful field that we have of horticulture. Thank you again for inviting me to give the lecture, and we do have a reception as well coming up. Thank you.
That was amazing. And I would have loved to hear about grasses and sedges next time. But I think you've provided us with a lot of challenges. I'm not even in a horticulture field, but I know there's some things on there that I can do personally as a paper scientist who cuts down trees for a living to make paper. But I know you're wondering, how did she get in here? So we have a little bit of time. Any questions for Dr. Meyer? And so if you have a question, I ask you to go to the microphone because we're recording this session. We're going to be working every year to broaden the reach of these lectures. And so please, the floor is yours. Any questions?
Yeah,
the reception is going to be right here in this room, so we're going to have a moment to set up. Okay. Yes, thank you.
So I'm somewhat familiar with the varieties of fruit that the University of Minnesota produces. Is Minnesota doing more to help us recognize the different varieties of plums and grapes and blueberries and strawberries that come out of that?
You know, not that I know of. We kind of are concentrated on apples. And people know the apple program so well in Minnesota that they want to be part of the naming. They want to know when the next apple is coming out. And Jim Luby and David Bedford are asked to talk a lot about that. So they always talk about what's coming next. And as good as you might think that Honeycrisp was, the Rave and First Kiss that came out, well, are coming out now, are really much better. They have much more flavor and so on. So people are kind of primed and ready and thinking about those apples. But beyond that, we have a lot of blueberries. And we talk locally about what the blueberries are, height-wise and so on. But no, I don't think we're doing enough, Amy. Thank you. Not enough.
So Dr. Meyer, I have a question. You know, we talk a lot in Washington, D.C. about food loss and waste and the whole science around extending shelf life and some of the other techniques that maybe plant breeders can help us with. Are there any specific challenges or ideas that you might want to share with the crowd about how we can be a part of the mitigating the loss of food?
Yeah, that really is a great point. I think that we're hardly realizing how much food loss there actually is. I have heard of a couple of instances with grocery stores where they're actually selling that produce or making that produce more available before it's actually thrown away. My husband does volunteer work at a food shelf, and he cannot believe the amount of food that comes in from the grocery stores. And if it doesn't get given out at the food shelf, it goes to the pig farms, which is certainly a form of waste. But I think that's something we kind of have to really analyze that and figure out where we're losing it all through the supply chain.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Okay.
I don't know if there's actually a question in here, but...
jump in, Ryan.
So, yes. So I love all of these side benefits. What are these so-called like soft science benefits of plants and these landscapes that we create? But I'm a scientist, I'm a plant breeder, and so I'm not very good at describing those. And they're kind of touchy-feely. You know, I actually describe, like, it does lower my blood pressure. I feel more relaxed. And I don't know how we connect better and allow somebody like me to describe those benefits better. I'm like, I feel better when I'm hanging out in my, you know, garden than I do when I'm hanging out on the sidewalk in front of my house. Without being like too touchy-feely for other people, to allow us to communicate the actual benefits of plants better. Because you talked about like antioxidants, and we live longer with a plant-based diet. That's easy to communicate as a scientist, but those other softer benefits are a little bit more challenging.
Right. I think that's really true. I think the other part of that is we as scientists, we're sometimes not the best communicators to the general public, and that is a challenge for us. When I was a graduate student at Cornell, I loved the fact that the communicators that would come in and interview us, and then they would write up the stories and do the communication, and the scientists, we kind of got off the hook from that. But that isn't what we need to be doing, because we need to continue to try to communicate what we're doing to the general public. But I agree, it's kind of two things there: the ability to communicate, and then the difficulty in describing the other benefits of horticulture, right? But they are so true, and I think that's what Dr. Sachs did. The fact that he could see the change in his patients that were severely ill and how they reacted when they were in a horticulture environment or were able to grow plants or manipulate plants, he saw that difference, right?
Okay. Well, if there are no further questions, thank you again, Dr. Meyer, for a wonderful presentation.